Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
This is Tuesday, November 12th, approximately 6 p.m. Had some difficulties with the internet connection, but I hope they're fixed now. Well, today's topic is deadly drug trials produce deadly drugs. This is really incredible. Of course, India, it was expected, but India blows the top off the development process of murderous drugs. These drug trials serve as a basis of FDA-approved approval and the drugs your doctor will offer you in your country, wherever you live, especially though the United States. And Dr. Daniels, that's me, explores the research behind these deadly drugs, and I reveal a solution that India stumbled upon, and actually many other countries are formulating solutions because the death toll from these trials is pretty high. And this has, of course, met with protests from drug companies who threatened actually to stop doing trials in countries that attempt to take action to defend their citizens. So I'm going to share with you what other countries have done to try and protect the lives of their citizens during drug trials and make drugs safer for everyone. And as always, we're going to have some natural solutions at the end. And I ask people to mail in the email the names of their favorite deadly drug when they've been exposed to. So we'll talk about a couple of those drugs as well. And I'll give the callers a chance to add a couple of their own. Okay, first I'm going to start with how I came to suspect that there must be some fraud in these drug trials. There must be some excess death or mortality or irregularity in how they're conducted. And also what this means really for the drugs your doctor's prescribing. And also what this means for placing natural therapies under the auspices of the FDA for development by drug companies and ultimately marketing to the public and what you can do about this. Now, I'd like to say for the end of this, people have asked me, oh, doctor, could you please just tell us the conclusion? Tell us the answer. Okay, so I'm going to tell you the answer. The answer is this. That there appears to be an element of malice and forethought in not only the design of these trials, but carrying them out. And so what we have then is really the complete full circle of what's going on in the United States and why 200,000 Americans every year are dying just from the drugs that they administer. Now, the total death toll, death by medicine, murder by medicine, is closer to 861,000, but that includes things like drug-resistant infections, doctor error, infected bed sores, surgical issues. But we're just talking about this 200,000. We're just talking about the doctor said, take this, it's good for you. The patient says, gosh, doc, I really appreciate it. The patient took it and dropped dead. So that's what we're talking about. This 200,000 only covers a little narrow sliver of things. And so I'm going to tell you how I knew drug trials must be harming, even killing people. And also how I know drugs are designed to harm, and how I know that a harmless substance absolutely cannot be approved as a drug. That's just not going to happen. And it turns out I'm not the only one wondering about this. Very interesting. An ex-columnist who writes for the Discovery Channel, of all things, penned an article, "Is It Safe to Participate in Drug Trials?" Bambi was her name. And her conclusion was, stay away from phase one trials. Now, what we're going to find out later, what I'll talk to you about, is that there's actually four phases in drug trials, 1, 2, 3, and 4. They are intended to be sequential because why test the drug when it's not safe to give? So the first trial, of course, is test it's safe. So there's a whole sequence of testing. I'll go over that. Now, I went to medical school in the dark ages. That would be the 1980s. In the 1980s, they told us doctors that we were very important people. We were brilliant people, far, far more intelligent than the average person, which I think is a bunch of nonsense. I think brilliance is actually everywhere, and every individual, and even every listener is actually brilliant. So I was a little puzzled when in medical school I was told that somehow I was brighter than anyone and everyone else. Now, we're also told that the healing methods we were using were so powerful that they could cause death in the wrong hands, and that the untrained mind of the patient could not possibly make the decisions necessary to use these drugs and procedures safely. And this is why. We called the prescription pad. We could prescribe drugs, and we had to give patients permission to use these drugs because these drugs were deadly. And so just this one little class in medical school made it very clear to me that the drugs I'm prescribing are dead. This is kind of in contradiction of the concept of an FDA. What does the FDA do? They make sure drugs are safe and effective. So we've got the FDA releasing deadly drugs that I'm going to be trained to use. Okay. So this was, I went to school in the 80s. That was a transition time where total dependence on the doctor by the patient was being incorporated. So in other words, the concept of patient as child or patient as infant was, they were trying to inculcate that not only into the doctor, but into the patient as well. I was being subjected to this, you're the parent, the patient's the child, and of course patients were being subjected to the propaganda that they couldn't possibly decide, and they had to blindly accept whatever the doctor gave. So there's two parallel education tracks going on at that time in the United States. Now, the next thing that happened was that I was told that as a doctor, I was totally dependent on the hospital. This is very interesting. And the hospital was a special place where close monitoring made it safe to prescribe lethal drugs. So that was the definition of the hospital. It was early 1980. As soon as I, you know, entered the medical profession, that's what I was told. A hospital is a place where deadly drugs are prescribed. So if you're not going to use deadly therapy, then the patient doesn't belong in the hospital. So the hospital is a place where close monitoring is safe to prescribe lethal drugs. And a good doctor knew when to use the hospital, of course, early and often. Now, there is a counter pressure at the time. Again, this is the 80s. Insurance companies noticed an increased hospital use and increased hospital costs. They intervened and said, whoa, slow down, slow down. You guys messing with our profits here. And so they started a policy whereby every hospital admission had to be justified on the basis that the therapy being given was so dangerous to the patient at the patient that could not and would not be safe for the patient to receive the same therapy at home. In other words, the therapy being given had to be dangerous in order to justify the hospital admission. So now we have a layer of danger. The drug is intrinsically lethal. But I, as a doctor, I'm getting special training here so I can prescribe in safe ways. But layered over that is an extra layer of danger. Now I have to have a lethal or potentially lethal situation in order to justify the patient being in the hospital in order for me, the doctor, to to get paid and for the hospital to get paid for this hospital admission. And so doctors would actually start an IV just to make sure they in the hospital got paid. Now, you guys are listening. You're probably thinking, an IV, no big deal. Well, it is a big deal because IVs, when they pierce the skin, can allow deadly bacteria to enter the blood, and people get blood infections and actually die. So what we think is you have a patient who's getting lethal drugs, and you add an unnecessary layer of danger to that just to make sure you get paid. So here we are multiplying the danger, multiplying the lethality. So we've got the hospital in the game, then the insurance company adds another layer of deadliness. And so then, as doctors, this is really drilled into us, we're not allowed to admit a patient to the hospital for something harmless, like, say, juice therapy. Why? It wasn't dangerous enough. Now, to their credit, in medical school, they did not mention something like juice therapy. However, during my transitional residency, this is a first-year residency after medical school, there was quite a commotion. A doctor admitted into the hospital for juice therapy for 4 days. So for 4 days, this patient received nothing but fresh squeezed juice. Now, this doctor was a climber, and his patient was one of the wealthy old doms of the Philadelphia Chestnut Hill District. This is the home of the rich and not so famous. Of course, she paid cash for her hospital stay. Nevertheless, the doctor was told not to do that again. Now, we residents were warned the doctor had defrauded that patient because he had not kept with MedY, government regulation, limiting patient choices only to modern methods was needed. Of course, this was very self-serving, and of course, I could not help but observe that the patients receiving these modern methods were not getting better. And of course, that lady who'd been defrauded at least did not suffer, and she left the hospital actually feeling pretty good. So in other words, if doctors were limited to using safe medications, the hospital would not be necessary because no better outcome could be expected by admitting the patient, right? So if you're giving something that's safe and in no way endangers the patient's life, then of course you can do that at home. You don't need the hospital for that. So then, the doctor's job became to prescribe deadly drugs in a safe manner in the confines of the hospital. Now, the increased monitoring we see in cardiac units, intensive care units, was supposed to make the use of these dangerous but necessary drugs safe. Of course, if you've been listening to my radio show, you realize that that never really did happen. As I mentioned before, even in 2010, 3 years ago, the estimate of deaths due to properly prescribed prescription drugs, this is inpatient, outpatient, $200,000, or 200,000 deaths every year. In the United States alone, so we're not even taking global numbers. So now, if these drugs are dangerous, how does one get them approved by the FDA? I mean, you have to do drug trials to prove it's effective. So my observation as a resident in training is that the drugs are clearly not effective, and clearly they were not safe. So the answer is the drug trials must be littered with maimed and murdered people. There's no other way because these drugs cause death and destruction. Then, if that's the case, then these data points, this information must be removed from the data of the clinical trials, or the deaths and harm must be attributed to another source. So that's why I came to the conclusion that without a doubt, the clinical trials absolutely, the data from the trials had to not be reflective of what actually went on in the trials. So let's take a look at the process. And this is really important to do is to take a look at what is the process, what's a clinical trial, and how does that take place. Okay, there's four phases of clinical trials. Now, I'll have to tell you honestly, in medical school, they only mentioned three phases. They did not mention four phases, and they really just went through it very quickly. Let me break it down to you so you know, and then you can understand exactly what's going on here. Something called phase zero. This is when a new drug is discovered. And usually phase zero involves giving the drug to an animal. Could be a dog, could be a cat, could be a guinea pig. Usually, a lot of times it's a guinea pig. That's why the guinea pigs are being used in all the experiment type discussions. If it's not safe for the animal, then that's it. End of whatever. No more trials. That's the end of it. You don't go on to phase one if the animal's getting this drug dropped dead. That's usually what happens, but that's actually not really what happened. For example, there's a famous drug, proton pump inhibitors, the purple pill. This would be like Prevacid, for example. The proton pump inhibitors were used in rats, and the rats consistently developed intestinal cancer at 8 weeks. Even though the animals developed intestinal cancer at 8 weeks and went on to die, this drug was still advanced to phase one with the screening for safety in humans. Now, since animals, the rats, all developed cancer at 8 weeks, it was deemed okay to go on to phase one, screening for safety in humans, as long as no human took the drug for more than 8 weeks. Okay, so went to screening for safety in humans. Then we go to phase two. So phase two, once you decide that it's safe, humans can take and not drop dead, it goes to phase two, where you establish that it works for what you think it's going to do. In this case, the proton pump inhibitors were believed or intended to relieve intestinal heartburn. It was believed that they did indeed do that, and it was hailed as a new miracle drug, so it was effective. Then phase three trials is a final confirmation of safety and effectiveness. Okay, so phase zero, is it safe for animals? One, is it safe for humans? Phase two, is it effective for humans? And phase three, you confirm safety and efficacy in the same trial. Okay, then there's phase four, and phase four is sell it to everyone who will buy it and keep track and see who drops dead, who lives, who gets better, kind of just monitor if the drug is really doing okay or if it's a problem drug. Okay. If you take a look at just the one example I gave you, which is H2 blockers, and proton pump inhibitors, one of which will be Prevacid, this really fell apart, right? Because what happened? Phase zero, okay, we showed it causes animals, consistently causes cancer in rats, gave it to humans for only 8 weeks or less, found there was no problem, then went on to effectiveness, decided yes, it was effective for the 8 week or less period, and then it was released to the public. And if you've ever been on a proton pump inhibitor, you know your doctor did not tell you you had to stop it at 8 weeks, correct? People are taking proton pump inhibitors for extended periods of time, and the incidence of esophageal cancer has increased sevenfold. So here we are. And, of course, then there's Century Studies during sales, and that's deteriorated to people reporting complications to the FDA, people complaining, trial lawyers getting in a game, gathering their own data, and working that way in a gap. The FDA has really failed to death. So what happens then when a drug fails to pass any of these trials? And one thing I alluded to is you just ignore phase one. Oh, it didn't work, no problem. Let's go on to phase two anyway. It doesn't work, no problem. Let's go on to phase three. Oh, it doesn't work, no problem. Let's handle it in phase four. Just do it anyway with the drug anyway. So but how does this happen? What is the administrative process? Okay, first of all, we have to rescue countries. What's a rescue country? Well, one big factor in a shift to clinical trials to foreign countries is approval and FDA regulations. So if studies in the United States suggest that a drug has no benefit, then trials from overseas can be used to to secure FDA approval. This is actually a policy. It's actually written this way. Amazing, but true. So there's even a term for countries that have been that have shown themselves to be especially amenable when drug companies need positive data fast, and they're called rescue countries. So rescue countries, for example, came to the aid of Ketek. This is an antibiotic. It's supposed to treat respiratory tract infections. It was developed in the 1990s. And in 2004, the FDA certified Ketek as safe and effective. And it was based on heavily on the results of studies in Hungary, Morocco, Tunisia, and Turkey. Mm-hmm. Now, it's common for the FDA to regulate and oversee studies that are done in the United States and to review test results. This is not done in overseas. So studies done overseas are not rigorously regulated or evaluated. In other words, the FDA doesn't send someone over there and say, hey, do these study subjects really exist? Did they really take this medicine? Are you guys keeping this, these things? Where's your paperwork? That is not a process that takes place. It does take place, but in less than 1% of studies. So they approve this drug less than 1 month after a major researcher in the United States was sentenced to 57 months in prison for falsifying Ketek data. And this is a doctor in Alabama, and she managed to sign up more than 1% of the town's adult population, including its entire office staff. She collected $400 for each individual from the drug company. And it later came to light that the data from at least 91% of patients was falsified. And so this issue with, of course, domestic drug trials. In this case, at least she had non-existent patients that she made up, whereas unfortunately in the overseas trials, often what happens is people really do take these. Now, he's like, Dr. Jones, where do you get this information? This information is from a publication called Vanity Fair. I think you guys should know about Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair, unlike its name, is not a trivial, superficial publication. Those of you who are into these conspiracy theories, I'm not saying they're true, I'm not saying false. But people who make very important decisions about the world read Vanity Fair. And so what Vanity Fair does is it gives them information so they can be the first to know which frauds are afoot. And so they can organize their lives so as to avoid these things. My sister, who's not a member of the Illuminati, she's a big fan of Vanity Fair and has been reading it for decades. I would suggest that would be a good book, periodical to keep up with. So now, how do people overseas consent to these trials? What's going on here? In many of these trials that are still a lot of trials take place in developed countries like Italy, Japan, but thousands taking place in countries with large concentrations of poor, illiterate people who, in some cases, sign their consent forms with a footprint or scratch an X. For example, Bangladesh, Malawi, Russian Federation, Romania, Thailand, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Peru, Iran, Turkey, Uganda, China, India. Really, a lot of places on the globe where there are plenty of poor people who really need the money. Now, in the United States, if a person agrees to participate in a drug trial, it's a cost for them to get paid $100 to $200 per day for agreeing to swallow a pill or take an injection. An individual for similar work in these poor countries will get paid $1 or even $2 a day. So you can see the great savings. And the two destinations that are really growing fast are China with 1,800 trials, and of course India's 1,400 trials. So the globalization of clinical trials for adult medications is not well known. There are many foreign trials going on for children, and especially in Argentina, in Santiago, one of the country's poorest. In 2008, seven babies participating in drug testing happen, was referred to as an adverse event. They died. These children took part in a medical trial to test the safety. Many of you recognize that as a required vaccine in the vaccine schedule, or one soon to be added. And it's developed by GlaxoSmithKline. And in all, at least 14 infants enrolled in clinical trials for the drug died during the test. And their parents, some illiterate, had their children signed up without understanding that the children were taking part in an experiment. And the local doctors who waited parents to enroll their babies received $350 per child. And that's a pretty low price to pay place in the life of a child. In New Delhi, 49 babies died in the India Institute of Medical Sciences while taking part in clinical trials over a 30-month period. They were given a variety of new drugs to treat everything from high blood pressure to chronic focal encephalitis with brain inflammation. And the blood pressure drugs had never before been given to anyone under 18. In fact, if you look at any blood pressure medication in the United States, poison control as well, it's immediate medical emergency. The kid, it's expected the kid faces the risk of death. So the editor of the medical journal said it was obvious that the trials were intended to extend patient life in Western countries with no consequences or benefit for India using Indian guinea pigs. Now, I think this editor of this medical journal is overly generous. I think what was happening with these children was the drug did to get these drugs okayed or cleared and used these children and their ultimate demise, of course, as part of a process to increase benefits. And these drugs, the danger of these drugs, of course, are never reported to the FDA or to the public in the United States. So there's no obligation to report the results of any study that's unfavorable. There is no obligation, in this case, to report every last drug adverse event, even if it is death. And in another case, there were 174 trials under the pediatric exclusivity provision. That's a special provision in the FDA, where if you test your drugs as being okay for kids, then you can get extension of your patent protection. So 9% of these studies did not report the location or number of sites of the clinical trials. Of those that did, 2/3 had been conducted at least one country outside the United States, 11% entirely outside the United States, and 79 trials with more than 100 subjects participating enrolled patients outside the United States. So, as is the case with adult studies, many children's trials were conducted abroad and not reported or categorized on any publicly accessible database. There's no record of their existence and no results. And so, obviously, you don't have to admit that the trial ever happened or the details of its happening. It's a strong moral hazard that a trial maybe was never done. In the mid-90s, now this is the mid-90s, and just to give you a little context, in the mid-90s, I was practicing medicine, and I was a medical director of a juvenile detention center where kids came in on SSRIs, antidepressant drugs, and I had observed the teaching hospital, write letters that were published by the editor of the newspaper, accusing me of endangering these children and not giving them their SSRI. So let's take a look and look at these studies and see what happened. So in the mid-90s, Glaxo conducted clinical trials of the antidepressant Paxil. And these trials were in the United States, Europe, and South America. And Paxil, as I mentioned before, is a drug called the SSRI, or serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor. It includes Zoloft, Prozac, Lexapro. And it's sold in the United Kingdom as Serac. Trials showed a beneficial effect on adolescents. And some of the trials indicated the placebo was more effective that drug itself. In other words, the drug actually made the students, the adolescents, worse. But Galactico did not share this information with consumers and probably didn't share it with the FDA either. And annual sales of the drug reached $5 billion in 2003. And really shocking. An internal memo, which was finally obtained by the Canadian Medical Association, the company emphasized how important it was to effectively manage the dissemination of these data. So what's happening then is we have phase two. So we say 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. We have phase 2, 3, and 4, or 2 and 3. These are important trials because phase 1 is safety, phase 2 is effectiveness, phase 3 confirms both safety and effectiveness. Now that effectively these drugs are skipping phase 2, 1, 2, and 3, and it's all being rolled into phase 4. So drugs are being released to the public when actually there are no trials indicating they're effective. So this is really shocking. This is so out of hand that lawyers have actually identified 8 drugs that doctors will not take. I have to ask, why would a doctor refuse to take any one particular drug? You can understand why they might not take any. Well, why would they be picky? Why would they not take this or that drug? Why would there be 8 drugs a doctor wouldn't take? Well, there's a couple of reasons. 2 reasons I can think of. 1, the doctor has observed firsthand that the drug has harmed many patients. And 2, it might be that the doctor participated in a clinical trial for the drug and saw the data before it was sanitized or scrubbed. This happened to me. There was a cholesterol drug, a big thing in the 90s to get everyone on cholesterol drugs. Well, we were at the point to get doctors to prescribe cholesterol drugs. So I was paid $50 for each 4 office visits over a period of time. And patients were not compensated at all. Patients did agree. They signed a consent form. And I was really surprised at the end of the 90-day trial. I had only 3 drugs, 3 patients signed up in the trial. But these 3 data points show the drug was totally effective, and the cholesterol levels actually increased during the trial. Obviously, my data points did not carry much weight because the drug, Tricor, was a cholesterol-lowering drug. I talked to other doctors who also had their patients in the study. And I said, hey, you know, his cholesterol went up during the study. And their response to me, I found very discouraging. And so the doctors told me that they knew what numbers to write in the study results. And this study had the effect of getting 90 days of this medication with hope that the patients would continue. I was absolutely shocked. I was flabbergasted when my patients told me that they would like to continue the drug. And I told them, look, in 9 days, your cholesterol hasn't gone down. You need to stop this medication. And so I took my patients off the drugs for sure. And compare this marketing, which is $150 for a 90-day study, which is what they paid me, $200 for a 90-day study. For a drug company to pay $1 a day for a study participant and then bribes to various physicians, hospital officials in decision-making positions. And so the drug companies send out scores of scouts to visit various cities and towns, large and small, all over the globe to find people who undergo clinical trials for new drugs and thereby help persuade the United States Food and Drug Administration to declare the drug safe and effective for Americans. So it's the next big step in globalization, and this does not look good. And it's a drug company shop in cities around the world where they convince poor people to take dangerous drugs. And those who die are buried as part of the trial. And those who show no benefit are also not counted. The data is then submitted to the FDA for approval of drugs to be used on you and your loved ones. This is in real time, today, 2013. So these reports and data are only from 2010, 2011. There's been no change in policies at the FDA to either use data collected on foreigners or to inspect foreign drug trials. Data is made available to the public purely voluntary basis. Again, accuracy unknown. Now, India has recently passed a law. So India has said, enough. I'm not doing this. You can come here if you want to. You can do drug trials if you want to. But you must pay all of an individual's medical benefits during the course of the drug trial to compensate their family in the event of their death. Now, if you're listening, you might say, wait a minute. What if the patient's sick? What is this? It turns out that they screen these people. They look for what's called drug-naive people. That means people who have never, ever taken the medication at any point in their life. This is the main role in trial. Now, a drug-naive individual would be in no way representative of the United States population, right? We've got mandatory drugging vaccines to start, so you're not even going to find a drug-naive person much beyond the age of 5 or 6. They use people who have never had a drug in their lives. And so under those circumstances, and people who are healthy, so a person is healthy, never had a drug before, and they become sick during a drug trial, that's a different story from maybe an American who might have an ongoing illness or whatever. So what the India policy does is it does not place the burden of proof on the individual. So this poor, impoverished person who's in a drug trial does not need to sue the drug to have their medical bills paid or their medical care provided or their conditions treated. And so this law was passed because so many individuals were being harmed. Now I talk about people dying or death. The truth of the matter is for every death, you've got 10 people who are permanently damaged, and that's just as much a tragedy. And so what's done in India is they said that the sponsor of a trial has an obligation to provide and manage the health problems of the participants, whether they're related or not to the drug under investigation. And what this does is it removes the process of arguing back and forth in the poll where a drug company can say, you can't prove it, or I won't do it, or too bad, or come soon. So it's like, no. Forget it. You know, any medical problem developing in the course of the drug trial is the drug company's responsibility. So India has not even instituted any punished trial investigators who don't get consent or who falsify records. But even the small step they have taken is an improvement. Germany had such problems with irregularities in the testing that what Germany said was drugs that were developed using research methods on unconsenting subjects, concealing side effects, and bribes of doctors for results would not receive approval by their approving body. And more to the point, if they found out those things took place, they would withdraw the drug approval. Again, this just showed you really how the practices are. I mean, the profit is so high and the bribery powers are just great that there's a limit to what these countries are able to do, but they are able to do something. And curiously, they're doing a lot more than what's being done in the United States. So I'd like to talk about the 8 drugs that I will not take. One is Advair. And this is an asthma medication and contains a long-acting beta agonist, which is salmeterol. And the problem with Sal Moreau is that it has contributed to as many as 5,000 in the United States annually. And so what the FDA has done is they've given a black box warning. Now, or a similar 12-hour beta agonist, 12-hour albuterol, came out when I was in medical school. And it marketed two puffs twice a day. We thought, well, go break through the bag, and take puffers four times a day. Well, it was the mid-80s, actually early 80s, like 1982, 1983. And I can't tell you the celebrities that were found dead with their 12-hour inhaler in their hand. And I think about three celebrities died. I don't watch TV or anything, so I don't remember their names, but it was quite something. And so, of course, the PR was they weren't using it properly, da-da-da-da. Oh, no, their asthma was so severe that the inhaler wasn't enough. But even as a medical student, I was like, that's a little shaky. So doctors won't take that. Vandia, this is a diabetic medicine. It's a pill. And so the Journal of the American Medical Association showed in a study that those taking diabetes drug Avandia for at least 1 year suffered an increased risk of heart failure, heart attack. And now, why does a diabetic treat their diabetes anyway? To lower their risk of getting a heart attack, which is a complication of diabetes, right? Wrong. It's a complication of diabetes medication. What they've done is they've asked the Avandia maker, which is GlaxoSmithKline, to conduct a long-term study assessing youth risk. Now, what do you want to bet that they might conduct that study overseas? And GlaxoSmithKline says they're going to wait a year before they get too wrapped up in it. Next is Celebrex. Celebrex is a pain medication linked to increased risk of stomach bleeding, kidney trouble, liver damage, and, of course, death. And heart attack. And so if you're taking 200 twice a day, you doubled your risk of heart attack. Those 400, if you took a 400 milligrams twice a day, you tripled your risk. Wait, back up. A third of Americans die of a heart attack, you tripled the risk. It's 100% risk. This is a dangerous drug. And two other drugs, Dextra and Vioxx, were banned, but Celebrex is still available. And then Ketec is an antibiotic prescribed for respiratory tract infections. And it's been linked to heart rhythm problems, liver disease, of course, death. And although it's still prescribed, and the FDA has limited use to just pneumonia. Then we have, of course, the Prilosec and Nexium. These are the drugs I mentioned, the H2 blockers that cause cancer at the 8-week period in. Now they've been linked to cardiac trouble, and they've raised pneumonia risk, osteoporosis risk, and fracture risk. And so, but those are still in the market. They haven't mentioned the esophageal cancer risk. I guess that's been kind of played. And of course, Sudafed is pretty much off the market, but it's a decongestant, but basically the methamphetamine. Or an ingredient to making your own methamphetamine at home. So I said that I would talk about the drugs that people wrote in about. Okay. First one is a shocker, the polio vaccine. Someone emailed saying they had the polio vaccine, and they think it's the cause of their fibromyalgia. This person is absolutely correct. If you read the polio vaccine package insert, this is written by the polio vaccine manufacturers themselves, not me, I'm not making it. They said the polio vaccine causes arthralgia, that means pain in every single joint you own, and myalgia, yes, pain throughout all of your muscles. And what is fibromyalgia but pain in all of your muscles? So, yes, polio vaccine does indeed cause fibromyalgia. Other votes were for aspirin and Plavix. Now, this is shocking. This never made it to me, but what, I mean, no one asked me, right? Who asked doctors what they think about these drugs? Drug companies put them out there and then tell doctors to test them. So a person saying, I had a stroke, then I was prescribed aspirin and Plavix and promptly had another stroke 2 days after starting these medications. I'll bet you did. Turns out that Plavix lawsuits have been filed for severe internal bleeding, heart attack, and stroke, and hemorrhages. In other words, Plavix, something that's supposed to prevent strokes, actually causes strokes. And so Plavix lawsuits have been filed for severe internal bleeding and lots of other things, just like I mentioned. And in England, they've actually taken a look. And they say, in the past 25 years, the number of strokes associated with blood-thinning drugs, such as aspirin or warfarin, has risen a fold 7 times as much. And if you're over 75, and this individual was in her 70s, there's no benefit to an aspirin a day because your stroke chances are even multiplied even more by taking an aspirin a day. And so while they say that taking an aspirin a day they're going to increase your stroke risk, for God's sakes, don't stop taking it. Keep taking it until you talk to your doctor. I find this absolutely shocking. And Plavix, of course, is on a recall watch list. In other words, because of problems with it, the FDA has put a black box warning on it saying, hey, this is more dangerous than we thought. And they're thinking about recalling it, but they haven't done that yet. So this is really, really shocking. And this is written by The Lancet, which is a very respected publication in England. It's the equivalent of the New England Journal of Medicine for England. And the proportion of patients who were on anti-clotting drugs was 4% 20 years ago. But 2 decades later, 40% of people who have strokes are on blood-thinning drugs, and these drugs are extremely, extremely dangerous and actually increase your chances of stroke. So it turns out that the data that is being used to evaluate drugs is so totally unreliable that you can't even make a case for taking a prescription drug because if your doctor is being lied to. He can put packages and what's on there totally unreliable. So what's the patient to do? If you're absolutely determined to take a medication of some sort, then definitely don't take any medication that's been on the market less than 3 years. And if you do decide to take a medication of any, definitely Google the medication to find out how many people have died from it. And if you can find people who have died from it, I wouldn't even bother to take it. I would recommend trying something natural. In the case of Plavix or aspirin, you're trying to make your blood thinner to prevent stroke. A gold thins the blood very, very well. And so I would really vigorously recommend glass of water. So additional glass of water. What time should you drink this glass of water? This is very important. You should drink the glass of water about an hour or two before bedtime and about an hour after waking. Most strokes happen because the person doesn't drink before bedtime. They go at least 12 hours with nothing to drink. They get up, they're in a hurry, they go about their business, and boom, the stroke happens. So you want to, if you hydrate yourself a couple hours before you go to bed, then you're going to wake up in good shape, and then about 2 hours after you wake up, 1 hour after you wake up, have another glass of water. And, of course, drink during the day. That's the thing to do. People have questions. Lots of times, you click your question button, and I'll answer them. Now, there are herbs you can take to thin blood, but quite frankly, a glass of water works beautifully. Now, this other person took a polio vaccine. Even the polio manufacturers are very rigorous in recommending that people who are adults do not take polio vaccine. And even though they recommend the polio vaccine, immunocompromised people like HIV-positive people, people with cancer, they all say that the vaccine is notoriously ineffective in those people. So in other words, there's hard to justify giving any adult a polio vaccine, so skip the vaccine. Okay, so you've got fibromyalgia. What can you do? The most important thing to do is detox. The simplest way to do that is to, of course, clean up your diet. You can go on my site, find out about that. But more importantly is you can apply castor oil from the waist down for 3 nights. That's what it is, liberate and loosen up all that junk that's stuck inside of you from the vaccine. And then if you're feeling fine after 3 days of doing that, then you can do a castor oil head oil. And that's going to shell this out of muscles and get rid of your fibromyalgia. What else will it do? It's going to ruin all of your sheets and your clothes. So I recommend getting some secondhand sheets while using the castor oil treatment. And that's what I'd recommend. Okay, we have a question here. Let me click here. Okay, you're on the air. You have a question about drugs and drug trials? Okay. Well, let's take our other answer.
Hi,
Heidi, how are you? Yes, I can.
Hi, good. Hi. You actually, you were answering the question I was going to ask, how to work with vaccines and specifically that polio vaccine.
Great. Yeah, that's the best. That is the best bet. The problem with vaccines of all kinds is that they're injected. And this is huge. This is huge. And so what happens when they're injected, I'll tell you, don't inject into a blood vessel, which is nice. But you have capillaries. Absolute itty-bitty blood vessels that are very small, one cell, one red blood cell at a time, single file, so these blood vessels. Well, still, these chemicals diffuse into the blood vessels and end up entering circulation. They end up circulating throughout the whole body. They end up diffusely attaching to various tissues. And so you really need a more comprehensive approach. In cleaning up your diet, you really have to absolutely clean up your diet. And that's a hard thing to do nowadays with genetically modified food, with organic foods that are not really organic, with chemtrails, with EMFs. So there's a lot of stuff to clean up. But I'd say start with, water next. Organic food is nice, but nothing like food out your backyard. Food out of your backyard, obviously you should not be using pesticides in your yard. Anything you can't get from your backyard, see if your neighbor will let you use stuff from their backyard. Can't get it from your yard, your neighbor's yard, start a garden. Barter with other people, but eat clean food, and you just cannot trust a grocery store. It's just not a fruitful way to go about things. So you got your food cleaned up, got your water supply cleaned up. You have to poop regularly, 3 times a day is what I recommend. You can go on my get Vitality capsules. That will help you poop regularly until you figure out another way, or they're perfectly safe for long-term use. But you really have to be fastidious. You just cannot, you can't half-step it. You can't have fibromyalgia and decide that you're going to drink super drinks instead of water. There's nothing better than water. Nothing better than water for a chronic pain situation. And in the case of a vaccine-induced chronic pain situation, that castor oil that you apply to your skin is very important because it acts diffusely throughout your whole body, penetrating and liberating toxins. You may want to do waist down until you're pain-free from the waist down and then extend the castor oil to the rest of your body. However you decide to do it, you just have to start and then progress. But vaccines are an excellent example of a drug where you have phase zero trial, which is they gave it to animals, I'm sure. So phase one, where you prove it's safe. Phase two, where you prove it's effective. And phase three, where you prove it's safe and effective. All three of these phases have been skipped. And so for vaccines, what we have is a big phase four where the safety of the drug, the effectiveness of the drug, are being determined by mass public use. Not by any studies or trials. What it has done then is it has simply bypassed the whole clinical trial process and simply score, which is used by the public with casual monitoring, if any. And this is something is really, you know, it's really unfortunate. Let me just check to see if we have any more questions. I'm here in Panama, as you know, and it's difficult. Oh, here we are. It's difficult to see if I have a full screen here, if I'm getting all the questions or not. My whole screen is filled with callers, and I don't know if I might be missing a question. Okay, there does not seem to be any more questions. So, same place, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. No, I don't have a topic yet, but I will email the topic for next week. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.